is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
I welcome my good colleague, Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired artilleryman, CBS News, visiting Professor Dickinson College, Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy, and the co-author with a book that is informative about nuclear weapons, entitled Tactical Nuclear Weapons and NATO, Once Upon a Time. I learned that in 2007, Russia rejected signing on to the very important Conventional Armed Forces in Europe Treaty of 1990, effective 1992. What that means is the news that came in these last days that the Zapad operation includes a tactical nuke training session between the Belarusian and Russian forces with tactical nuclear weapons forward deployed in Belarus is part of Russia's not only saber rattling, but it looks very much part of their war planning. Jeff, a very good evening to you. You wrote the book about tactical nuclear weapons in NATO. Does NATO have a comparable exercise to what we've witnessed at Zapad? Are both sides rattling sabers at each other? I thought we put that genie back in the bottle. Good evening to you.
Good evening to you, John. NATO still conducts exercises and planning on the employment of so-called tactical or theater nuclear weapons as part of what's called the nuclear planning group, the sharing of the use of nuclear weapons if that was required. The United States maintains about 500, again, tactical or theater nuclear weapons in Europe. At the high point of the Cold War, we and the Soviets probably maintained 30,000 such tactical nuclear weapons each on both sides. And those particular arsenals were reduced under two parallel agreements, presidential directives, one signed by George Herbert Walker Bush and one signed by Mr. Gorbachev at the end of the Cold War. And we subsequently then reduced our tactical nuclear weapons dramatically, which had up to that point, in my experience, included artillery shells, short-range missiles, rockets, so-called atomic demolition munitions, if you will, nuclear landmines, as well as bombs that could be delivered by short-legged airplanes. The Russians maintain a force of somewhere around 1,000 to 2,000, again, tactical nuclear weapons. They are not constrained by the New START agreement, and the Russians argued they needed to maintain that level of force because of NATO's overwhelming conventional superiority. Oddly, that was the same argument NATO used during the Cold War to rationalize why we kept lots of tactical nuclear weapons when we opposed the Soviet Union. And when they withdrew from, they had signed on to the CFE treaty, which was constraining not the weapons so much, but the platforms, missiles, rockets, artillery, et cetera. They withdrew from that, and they also now still maintain that tactical nuclear stockpile, as you mentioned. But they have, the Russians have demonstrated and trained with some of those capabilities during this upcoming ongoing Zapad 2025 exercise, I should say. And NATO does similar things periodically in terms of either just planning exercises or air exercises that involve the allies who have the weapons on their territory, which right now, and their American weapons, include Turkey, Italy, Germany, Belgium, and Holland. And they maintain those particular weapons controlled by the U.S., to be transferred to flight crews from those respective countries at a time of crisis when the weapons would have to be delivered.
I'm told that of the 19 so-called drones that crossed into Polish territory, said to be an accident or lost their way, at least one of them had a long-range tank on it. Does that make this an accidental occasion or a probe?
Well, I'll quote a leading Polish official who says, you can't make 19 mistakes on the same day. That's a pretty heady coincidence. So I reject the notion that this was any kind of a mistake or a coincidence. But this was a planned event. There are reports that at least four or five of these particular drones were heading in the direction of a major NATO-Polish airbase. And you're quite right. Reports I read as well suggest that at least several of these were a variant that the Russians have created from the Shahed Iranian drone, which in some cases, because they're decoys, are made out of styrofoam and wood, so they're very cheap, but they have lighter payloads, so they can fly farther. They can carry explosives, and they were carrying larger fuel tanks, which apparently would extend their range up to something like 400 to 500 miles.
We move from the Polish-Russian-Belarusian frontier to Gaza. As of 24 hours past, the IDF has launched an offensive against an urban environment that has largely been undamaged since the beginning of the war in 23. Now we witness the taking down of large tower buildings because we're told they're observation points. The IDF is prepared to go in with its heavy armor, and one general at least said this will take 6 months. What to watch for in urban fighting, Jeff? Because my memory is the second war. Is it out of date how difficult this is?
Yeah, it is very difficult. And I was in Fallujah in Iraq shortly after we went into that city. Fallujah was somewhat smaller than Gaza. It had about 300,000 people. We believe there's about 600,000 to 700,000 people perhaps still in Gaza. A large number have, in fact, evacuated. That particular fight took us up to 6 weeks because in urban warfare, you have to move very deliberately. And a lot of the advantages the Israelis enjoy in terms of tanks and artillery or personnel carriers, you lose that as you're moving through the streets. So in preparation for this attack, we see the Israelis trying to hit a lot of the large towers, tower apartment buildings in Gaza City. Why would they hit those? Because what we found happening is terrorist groups, insurgents would position people with anti-tank weapons and whatever in the upper floors to shoot down at the armored personnel carriers, tanks coming through the street, knowing full well the thinnest armor on those particular vehicles is the top. And so that makes you move very deliberately. Israelis and IDF, frankly, are very well known for being very casualty adverse. They want to minimize the number of casualties. We lost about 100 killed in action in Fallujah alone. And so as a consequence, they're going to go block by block. Unfortunately, I think they'll use a lot of airstrikes. In the last 24 hours, I've read they have conducted up to 150 airstrikes on Gaza City alone. They'll probably use a lot of artillery to basically destroy the insurgents that are still there. But what I find phenomenal, John, is when we started talking about this war several years ago, the estimates were Hamas had 25 to 30,000 fighters. And now the IDF is saying to this day, there's still 1,000 just in Gaza City alone. Even though the Israelis pretty much accept the number put out by the health ministry in Gaza, that over 65,000 people have been killed. So we basically, if they were all fighters, killed everybody Hamas had about 2 to 2.5 times. They still argue there are 1,000 Hamas fighters in Gaza alone. Another reason why they'll move very slowly and very deliberately is, of course, it's believed that the 20 so-called living hostages may well be in Gaza City in some effort to hopefully protect them from Gaza, from collateral damage. But one last word or anecdote, John, in Fallujah, when I was in Fallujah, every building had 2 huge X's on it, every building. Why did it have 2 huge X's? Because every building had to be searched, every room, every basement, every closet for weapons to make sure that insurgents, terrorists couldn't come in behind you. And then it was searched a second time. So to move forward, you had to search each building in a city of 300,000 and then mark it twice before you moved on to the next block.
6 months. You like that timeline?
Yeah, it's an estimate. Again, I think that's probably not far off the mark. Again, that's a little bit about twice what it took us in Fallujah. And Fallujah was somewhat smaller. It took roughly that period of time, about 9 months for us to and the Iraqis to move through Mosul. Mosul, though, is quite a bit larger. But I come back to this being risk averse and therefore moving deliberately and the problem of the hostages, which may make the Israelis even move more slowly.
Venezuela. There is a flotilla off the coast between Venezuela and Puerto Rico. There's a war game exercise underway in Puerto Rico, I'm told. There's a Marine Expeditionary Unit. There are air elements, F-35s. Harriers are there, I believe, and the attack helicopters along with the Ospreys for taking Marines in. This is a lot of firepower for one guy, Maduro, who's declared a cartel leader and a gangster with a $50 million reward on his head. The U.S. Navy doesn't arrest people, but I'm told there's a Coast Guard unit on board one of the ships that does arrest DEA. So far, you tell me now 3 boats have been destroyed from the air, Jeff? 3?
That's the report, John. Mr. Trump recently announced a 3rd boat had been struck, but provided no details on that. And obviously, the big challenge there is, as you kind of suggest, whereas the Coast Guard is legally empowered to intercept suspicious boats that are conducting smuggling or perhaps transferring drugs in the Caribbean and does that routinely. And that's okay under international law and arrests those participating in it. There is no basis under international law that I can ascertain, and seems even some senior Republicans are questioning this, for the outright just destruction of these particular vessels and simply saying, well, they were full of narco-terrorists. And somebody says, well, how do you prove that? Mr. Trump's reply, the Pentagon's replies, well, we know that's who was there, while providing no further details.
There seems to be a mismatch in firepower. I'm told that there are not enough rifles in Venezuela for the militia. I'm told that the army, such as it is, needs to go home to their houses at night to eat because there's not enough food in barracks. I'm told that the so-called 25,000 that Maduro has dispatched to the frontier don't really exist. Jeff, there's no there for the Navy flotilla to take on. So what is it for?
Well, I think it's there to destabilize the country. And hopefully some belief that this presence and this attacking these particular vessels will destabilize and perhaps bring on some kind of social unrest that will bring Maduro down. And secondly, maybe there is a deterrent. One of the other concerns has always been Venezuela has for several years now claimed that a large portion of the neighboring country of Guyana is actually part of Venezuela. And that particular area has supposedly large oil reserves that the United States is interested in. So it may be able to deter Venezuela from expanding that. I think thirdly, it's part and parcel of something I think is really very interesting, and that is the new national military strategy is due to be put out by the Pentagon very shortly. And one thing the Trump administration appears to be doing is a wholesale redirection of the primary responsibilities of U.S. military strategy, and that Russia will no longer be a major threat, and even China will not be the primary threat. The primary threat will be domestic security of the United States, and as a consequence, sending National Guardsmen into American cities, using the Navy to destroy so-called narco-terrorists in the Caribbean, building up to and spending up to, and some suggest, several $1 trillion on Golden Dome to protect the homeland. The whole emphasis on the homeland may be demonstrated by what Mr. Trump's trying to do with Venezuela.
I'm speaking to Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired, CBS News, Dickinson College, Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy. What can go wrong and why when we come back? I'm John Batchelor.